Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to appear at the Philadelphia Society. Igor Stravinsky once let it be known that he disliked the works of German composer Richard Strauss. So someone asked Maestro, could you be more specific? And Stravinsky responded, yes. I do not like the major works, and I do not like the minor works. In a somewhat similar fashion, since my task is anti-Americanism in the Muslim world, I can tell you they do not like our vices, and they do not like our virtues. That's not to create the impression, however, that they thought about us much at all, which they didn't for most of their existence. Islam is a very self-referential world, and there are not many points of reference outside of it until they are forced upon them. Thus it was that no Middle Eastern country opened an embassy in Washington until the Ottomans in 1873. The mutual neglect was reciprocal. It was not until 1909 that the U.S. State Department created its Near Eastern Affairs Division. In 1913, Assistant Secretary of State Francis Huntington Wilson announced, quote, it's no place for us to waste ammunition, unquote. Obviously, the thinking changed. Now, I would like to start here with a little thought experiment. I'm going to read to you a statement, and I want you to guess who said it. Quote, this great America, what is its worth in the scale of human values? And what does it add to the moral account of humanity? And by journey's end, what will its contribution be? I fear that a balance may not exist between America's material greatness and the quality of its people. And I fear that the wheel of life will have turned, and the book of time will have closed, and that America will have added nothing, or next to nothing, to the account of morals that distinguishes man from object, and indeed, mankind from animals. Unquote. Who do you think? Billy Graham? Solzhenitsyn? Who? Khomeini? Joe's close. That's a Chicago street smarts thinker over there. I've read that quote to, I lecture mid-career American officers frequently. I read the quote, and who do you think said it? The last answer I got was Churchill. No, it's not your... Oh, you have a guess, sir.
Ahmadinejad.
You're staying a little bit... Who's in the back?
The President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Who did it?
Putin.
It was. It's the name that you heard last night in the eloquent dinner speech from John O'Sullivan. It's Syed Qutb. It's Syed Qutb. And... the word Qutb, you know, in Arabic means the pole around which the world revolves on its axis. And I tell you, the entire Islamist world revolves around the thinking of this man who was hanged by Nasser in 1966. But go into any Islamic bookstore, go into the bookstalls in Cairo, anywhere, it's Syed Qutb. Go into Afghanistan and the Taliban, it's Syed Qutb's thought that animates them. Now, the value of the Qutb quote is that it so clearly illustrates the moral judgment on America that is behind the Islamist movement. This is such an important point. I'd like to give you a couple of more contemporary examples. One member of the team that carried out the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 was Mahmoud Abu Halima. He had this to say in an interview, quote, the soul of religion, that is what is missing. The 17 years he lived in the West, Abu Halima said, quote, is a fair amount of time to understand what the hell is going on in the United States and in Europe about secularism or people you know who have no religion. I have lived their life, but they didn't live my life, so they will never understand the way I live or the way I think." Unquote. Abu Halima compared a life without religion to a pen without ink. Quote, "An ink pen, a pen worth $2,000, gold and everything in it. It's useless if there's no ink in it. That's the thing that gives life, the life in this pen, the soul, the religion, you know, that's the thing that's revived the whole life. Secularism has none, they have none, you have none." Unquote. Recent broadcast from Al Nas TV in Lebanon, featuring young Egyptian children preaching about Jerusalem. Quote, "The West has industry, tourism, and sites that tempt us, but it is devoid of faith. The West is still a graveyard for principles." Unquote. You can find this material daily on Islamic websites. Go to MEMRI, Middle East Media Research Institute, and you can listen to it with subtitles in English or read the articles. Notice that none of these critiques above addresses any policy problems. Pace, my friend John Utley. Those who insist that America's public diplomacy nightmare in the Middle East is only due to its policies mistake the fundamentally moral nature of the attack. In fact, there is no policy the U.S. could change in the Middle East that would reverse this moral condemnation, including the abandonment of Israel. When Qutb wrote his statement in The America I Have Seen in the early 1950s, after attending that dance John O'Sullivan talked about in Greeley, Israel was not the major issue it is today, nor were we seen as the sponsors of the autocracies in the region. Now, that raises another interesting point, because everyone has puzzled over not only why do they hate us, but we were once so popular in the Middle East. How is it that we are now unpopular, and can't we restore that popularity, perhaps by having President Obama speak at Al-Azhar University? Let me give you just a short example as to why this was so. Before the First World War, the British and the French thought that the Arabs were suppressed and kept under heel by Ottoman imperialism. And if only the dead hand of Ottoman imperialism could be lifted from the Arab peoples, they would assume the blessings of liberty and self-government. Thus, World War I ensued, the romance of Lawrence of Arabia, but they discovered with the fiasco in Damascus afterwards that it didn't appear to them that they were ready for the blessings of liberty and self-government, and thus the UN mandates were created, and the British and the French began ruling the Middle East. The United States adopted a version of this perspective, except now applied it to European colonialism. And we, as the world's anti-colonial policy, said, but for the dead hand of European colonialism upon the Arab peoples, they would assume the liberty their liberties and self-government. And so, indeed, our policies were anti-colonial against the British, or the remnant of the British Empire, and the French in Syria. And in 1956, when they occupied Sinai, Eisenhower ordered them out. Great Britain, the French and the Israelis to get out. Understandably, in the Arab world, as a consequence of this, we were terrifically popular. Exhausted by World War II and their exertions, they did leave. They went home. And all of a sudden, those problems became ours. And we soon discovered that they weren't the result of Ottoman or European imperialism, but that the problems were indigenous. The difference being, now they were ours. And that was the end of our popularity in the Middle East. And a speech at Al-Azhar University is not going to restore it. There are other reasons for our unpopularity. Self-inflicted. As far back as 1952, the Lebanese philosopher and one of the principal authors of the UN Declaration on Human Rights, the great Charles Malik, said, quote, "The West did not offer the highest good of its positive tradition, but the false gods of modern Western civilization, nationalism, materialism, communism," unquote. Around that same time, Palestinian Arab Fayez Saeq blamed the West for not having presented its true values. He listed Plato, Aquinas, Shakespeare, Goethe, Dostoevsky, which, quote, "represent the authentic character of the West more boldly and persuasively." Since the West failed in this way, he said, the Arabs also failed to make a distinction between an imperialist and economically exploitative West and the authentic West. Consequently, they rejected the chance the West offered for their improvement and progress, thereby courting spiritual stagnation, unquote. My old teacher, Professor Harry Jaffa, expresses what's wrong with the U.S. approach to the Middle East and generally with his statement that we are telling others to accept the forms of our own political institutions without any reference to the principles or convictions that give rise to those institutions, unquote. In my years of working in public diplomacy at the U.S. Information Agency, the White House, Defense Department, State Department, I guarantee you we never once referenced Dostoevsky, Goethe, or any other non-American. Rather, we have done something else that John O'Sullivan knows a thing about, as do I, because what we did instead, in the face of a pop culture that has polluted the world, is decide to officially embrace that pop culture as representatives of ourselves. 9, 10 years ago, when I was privileged to address the Philadelphia Society as the director of Voice of America, we were in the process of ending our Arab service, which was 12 hours a day, rich in discussion, reviews, serious intellectual content, with a 24/7 pop music station that blended Arab pop music with Britney Spears, J-Lo, and Eminem. What do you think? It wasn't Dostoevsky or Goethe or the rest of them. Many Muslims see globalization, particularly of the media, and the pop culture of anything goes that carries with it as an aggressive attempt to destroy the moral basis of their society. Can that be a surprise? It's destroying the moral basis of our society, which is why they react so strongly against it. Since the whole purpose of Islam is the construction of a virtuous society, such a danger to it is easily seen as an attack on Islam itself. We must understand the thing that Muslims loathe the most is not Christianity or Judaism, but unbelief. As Egyptian Jesuit Samir Khalil Samir has written, quote, "Muslims are not offended by religious symbols, but by secularized culture, by the fact that God and the values that they associate with God are absent from this Western civilization," unquote. I remember one of a friend of mine, Colonel Nate Slate, he's one of our real American heroes about whom you know nothing, serving bravely in Al-Anbar province in Iraq. When the chaplain was coming to visit, they got official notification from the chain of command, oh, make sure the chaplain doesn't wear any religious symbols as you're in a Muslim environment. Colonel Slate said, the hell with that. The chaplain showed up with the cross on his insignia. The Muslims were thrilled. The Americans' imam had come. This was terrific. The children came out. The village had a celebration. Sometime after, an IED almost took Colonel Slate out, blew up under his vehicle. He survived. The imams of the region declared a month of prayer for the safety of Colonel Slate. I'm reminded of this story because as our troops have now left Iraq, one of the Iraqis were asked, now you've had 10 years of these Americans and they're going, what do you think of them? And the response was, you're better than your movies. And I had always thought, as had Ed Fulner when he was head of the Public Diplomacy Commission under President Reagan, that our job in U.S. public diplomacy was to make sure they knew about that other America that is so distorted in our pop culture and which we have failed so miserably in doing. In many Muslim minds, democracy has become equated with unbelief. In fact, that is the message we have inadvertently helped to spread. Therefore, the promotion of democracy is seen as the most dangerous challenge to their faith. Can you imagine that several blocks from the Independence Hall where the American Creed was formulated, based on the laws of nature and nature's God, our impression of ourselves, self-inflicted and broadcast by pop culture and embraced by the public diplomacy of the United States, leads people to believe that democracy is a form of unbelief. On the other hand, in Obama's one of his autobiographical volumes, he opined that the principle underlying the American Constitution is that there are no absolute truths. How would you like to tell the troops they're fighting for that? So just at the just when we had better addressed the moral critique of the United States as a godless secular society immersed in materialism, the moral basis of American life may be eroding. And it's precisely this basis we most need to present to the Muslim world if we're to diffuse that contempt and anger that our popular culture generates. Okay, those are our vices. Why don't they like our virtues? I'll just give you a couple of quick quotes that illustrate this. Here's the first one. From Al-Qaeda spokesman Suleiman Abu Ghaith, quote, America is the head of heresy in our modern world, and it leads an infidel democratic regime that is based upon the separation of religion and state and on ruling the people by the people via legislating laws that contradict the way of Allah and permit what Allah has prohibited, unquote. Infidel regime because it's the rule of the people by the people. Didn't someone from Illinois say that, Joe? What's that? Second quote, Al-Qaeda author Yusuf al-Yere, killed in a 2000 gun battle in Riyadh, he wrote this in his last book, The Future of Iraq and the Arabian Peninsula After the Fall of Baghdad. Quote, it is not the American war machine that should be of the utmost concern to Muslims. What threatens the future of Islam, in fact, its very survival, is American democracy. Unquote. Why does American democracy threaten the existence of Islam? This will take a couple of sentences about a fundamental basic tenets in Islam. Judaism gave us Genesis, in which man is described as having been created in the image and likeness of God. This revelation is the basis of our civilization, as well as the foundation of democracy. The Quran, on the other hand, makes explicitly clear that man is not made in God's image, and to suggest otherwise is blasphemy. I went to an interfaith iftar dinner last Ramadan, at which there was a rabbi, an evangelical preacher, and an imam. Sudanese Sufi imam. The rabbi got up and said, we're all here together, brothers and sisters, as each one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. So how could we not be together? Lovely. Thank you, Rabbi. the evangelical preacher got up and said, as the rabbi said, we are all made in the image and likeness of God, and this is the basis of our brotherhood. The imam got up and made a very lovely statement, but of course he didn't say that. So I went up to him privately afterwards and I said, Imam, I noticed you didn't say we were all made in the image and likeness of God. Could you, as a Muslim, make that remark? And he sort of blanched and said, well, we're all equally made by God. I said, yes, I know that, but that's not quite the same thing. It's a form of blasphemy to associate anything with Allah. To say that you have God's image in you is a gross blasphemy in Islam. And that is why man is not sovereign. In the wonderful luncheon talk today, you heard each individual is sovereign. Last night you heard in our civilization, man is sovereign. In Islam, I assure you, man is not sovereign. Only God is sovereign. And that's why democracy has never developed indigenously within the Islamic world because of this theological tenet. The theory of democracy in Islam that I once constructed goes like this. One God, one vote, one time. Thank you.
Okay, now it's time for questions.
Eric Bootsma again. My question revolves around Europe, and I was thinking about, in my experience in traveling in Europe, whenever I ask people there, do you hate Americans? Well, no, not really, not individual Americans, but the Germans. They really distrust each other, and what we've seen in the last year with sort of the EU, the cracks are starting to show there. That the EU is not really what it turned out to be. That I think coming from my heritage being Dutch and just seeing it in a lot of the smaller countries, there's a lot of distrust of the EU as becoming the way that the hegemonies of Germany, France, and England have taken over Europe economically rather than militarily. And I wonder, will the anti-Americanism of Europe be replaced with that infighting again? And then I guess the second question is to Mr. Riley, if Europeans stop having children, will it even matter? In other words, will Islam just take over Europe?
Your name?
My name is Eric Bootsma. Thank you.
Well, you've already seen some instances of this and the reactions, particularly of the Greeks, to the Germans and the various European Union efforts to bail out the Greeks. It's been obviously the Germans are the bankers. And a lot of the resentment against the Nazi occupation of Greece that had been more or less, not forgotten, but hadn't been emphasized, is now making itself back in the Greek press in reaction to the austerity measures, which may be imposed by the European Union, but they all believe in Greece that it's the Germans that are behind it. The Germans for many years were hiding behind the European Union. They weren't asserting themselves, and now they are. They are starting to assert themselves because they're the bankers of the European Union and of Europe, and it is creating a backlash. And the European Union is, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's falling apart, but the euro is in crisis, and the more this happens, the pretense of there actually being a European national identity will become very obvious, even to those who have believed in it, because the whole European project was political. It was ideological. It was driven for a whole lot of reasons, not just the ones that I gave, but also because there were certain economic and national interests that each of the countries had. And it's like the emperor now has no clothes, because the welfare state that was the engine behind creating the European unification movement is falling apart. You have debt, obviously, in Spain and Portugal and elsewhere that's now around the corner. So this is a crisis in this, I would say, a real crisis, not just one in the imagination of the whole European project.
Yusuf Qaradawi, who is the perhaps the most influential Sunni imam in the world today, refers to jihad of the womb as the means by which the Muslims will retake Europe. So you're quite correct in that respect. Due to the demographic disastrous decline in Europe, I would only add as a side note that the Muslim countries are now in demographic decline also. The problem, I visit Europe fairly often, and I see Muslims there. There are not that many. Were there something left to assimilate into, it wouldn't be the problem that it is.
Thank you.
Thank you. And listening to Robert Reilly is always a wonderful experience. Really is. Bob, the point, the intercepts, our intelligence intercepts thousands of messages among the different Muslim groups. It was commented once that 90% of them is about their hating each other, and only 10 barely is about America, about our issues. The point where they have a vote, ever the few votes they have, their fundamentalists get very little support. Most people in the rest of the world want some of the goodies of Western civilization. They want freedom. They want some respect, all sorts of things. They don't follow the people that get repeated constantly in the American interventionist media, etc. The answer to what you say, when the Muslim world is going through this chaos, we get involved. The best thing for us is to stay out. And that's William Lind, Paul Weyrich's main aide, used to argue that in this chaos, we're better to stay out, otherwise it turns against us. It's not only Israel, as you said. We had an article in the American Conservative once, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Imperialists, by Jim Pinkerton. And one of it was send your children to learn their languages. America, everything in these countries is based on personal relationships. The United States, I and others argue, we are just incapable of having a competent policy. One big issue, everything is personal relationships in nations without a rule of law. America sends in these officers and advisors, and then a year later, they're rotated out,
right,
just when they've got some confidence with the locals. We are just incapable of doing the kind of intelligent policies you would have. Lastly, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, did not have lobbies. The Romans didn't have an Egyptian lobby helping deciding their foreign policy in these different countries. We're subject to that. It's not just the Israeli lobby. Obviously, in the war with Albania, we had Albanians who talked like Americans and were Americans pushing us into that war.
Right, John, if I could just quickly say two things there. First of all, you're absolutely...
Let me make the final point.
Well, John, your question. There are many people in the
go
line.
Go ahead.
There's a big line behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so first of all, you're absolutely right. Most of the violence is intra-Muslim. They're killing each other far more than they're killing us. But you're wrong about the fundamentalist vote. Everything that the Arab Spring has revealed is the strength of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists. As you know, they won 70% in Egypt, and they won pluralities in Tunisia, the most secular, enlightened of the countries. It shows just the opposite of what you're saying, unfortunately. Thanks.
And lastly, we should be a beacon, not a policeman. We are incompetent as policemen, but as a beacon, America has tremendous appeal all over the world still.
Thank you.
Thank you. There's one.
Hi, my name is Kevin Mooney. I'm with the Pelican Institute. Professor Holmes, I think you spoke a bit about the separation between European elites and the average European. It seems to me that whenever the average person in Europe has a shot at it, by that I mean the EU Constitution, it gets voted down in France, in the Netherlands, and I think Ireland, too. Another component of that, I think, is the collapse of the global warming movement. There's a new UN summit coming up, I think, in July in Rio or June. And I've noticed they don't say global warming anymore. They say sustainability. It's the same anti-energy, anti-American agenda. And it seems to me like the incubators of anti-Americanism are running into some trouble in Europe, even if they're not in love with us. It seems to me that the elites are sort of wearing thin with their own people.
I think that's right. Just very quickly, you got a lot of people behind you. But, you know, the steam is running out of the European movement on a lot of fronts. And the ones I mentioned, the ones you mentioned there, the climate change was really, you know, why? How can you explain the European obsession with global warming? There's lots of reasons behind it, but one was is that ideologically it fit into the whole machinery of global governance, both at the United Nations and in the European Union and in the Commission. It's just like a hand going in a glove in terms of bringing more of the taxpayers' resources into studying this and then changing the structure of the economies. All of that was there as well. But the fact that now they're in this tremendous debt crisis, it's not only the fact that they're having some questions about global warming, but they don't have money to do this anymore. I mean, the luxury to doing this kind of thing. So the wheels are coming off of this vehicle in many different ways. I don't know where it's going. I think that hopefully that they can come up with some kind of a new European association. It's not further integration that doesn't destroy the nation state. And I know that some people think that if they don't have the European Union, they'll all go back to killing one another in a war. And I just don't believe that. I think that they have moved on from that period of their history, and they don't need the European Commission to keep them killing one another.
Ms. Wang?
I'm glad this microphone suited to my stature. travel size. This is for Mr. Riley. I've benefited enormously from reading your writings on Islam, and it's always a pleasure to hear you speak. I am afraid your little, maybe hope is triumphing, and that's always a danger. In what you were saying is, isn't it the churches that Boko Haram is targeting in Nigeria? Isn't it churches that are Christians who are being driven out, religious Christians who were driven out of Iraq by the hundreds of thousands? I would put it to you that they hate our virtues too, and Islam is fundamentally incompatible with the West, and it may be that our greatest weapon is our culture of death, and the fact that Muslim demography is collapsing might be the best thing. So would you say maybe Prime Minister Netanyahu was right when he said the best thing we could do with Iran is to drop thousands of copies of Sex and the City, dubbed into Farsi, on the country of Iran? I hate to say this, but, you know, shouldn't we really just be promoting feminism in the Muslim world? Because it almost killed us, but since, as a Christian, I believe we will survive everything, presumably we've been sort of vaccinated against it. Honestly, and this sounds terribly Machiavellian, but maybe they're right to be promoting gangster rap over there? Because if Islam, as your own book suggests, is almost impossible to reform to be compatible with pluralism.
I think if you would like them to hate us even more, promoting feminism is a terrific idea.
Yeah, but there won't be very many of them soon. I mean, look, honestly, isn't
the
Muslim
birth... Yes, you're right, there won't.
That's right. I mean, isn't the Muslim birth rate and willingness to blow themselves up, aren't those their only weapons? I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound hostile. I don't hate these people. We're talking about a global confrontation.
Yes, well, first of all, John Utley, I completely agree with John, is that going into a Muslim country as a Western country, which they interpret solely as the Crusaders are back, is a bad idea. It's the last thing we should ever do. And the only reason we have to do it, it's the same reason the British and French were doing it, because someone has to keep the supply of oil being pumped. I said that on a Middle Eastern TV station once, and they said, oh, so this plot, this secret, really is that, the oil? I said, how could anything that obvious be a secret?
So maybe we should embrace wind power.
Well, we first of all, we ought to drill, baby, drill.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Wallen, first of all, it is always a great honor to be able to listen to Professor Pipes as well as read him. And Robert, I must say, I'm beginning to think the same of you. But I have a question for Dr. Holmes. Toward the interview remarks, you were talking about... it wasn't meant to leave you out. Bob and I are just older friends. That's all
right.
but when towards the end of your remarks about the European Union... I'm just wondering if that could be furthered just a little bit. Yes, Europe used to be, all of it used to be the law of the claw and of the lion's tooth and war without end. And now they don't have it anymore after two world wars, and they now have us and have had for some time to protect them. Mm-hmm. And I do think that has much to do with their view of world policy. But I'm wondering if maybe it's leading even to a more serious problem, and that is what's really come to take place is that the European Union, which really is becoming more and more Europe, I think, is postmodern. That is to say, they really have come to believe that there is nothing worth risking life for. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of Marx's 1844 manuscript, where one of the few places he talks about what might actually happen after the Great Transformation. And the lion lies down with the lamb. There's no more conflict, no more war, but of course also no more love, because there's nothing worth fighting and dying for. And it seems to me that what's now starting to come up is between the Europeans and the U.S. They dislike us not only because we've replaced them as an empire, but we are an embarrassment to them. Mm-hmm. We create a deep resentment and a self-loathing, I think, in some respects, that they're unwilling to face. And so it's much easier to dismiss us as naive, backward rubes who aren't aware of all the problems their country faces. I just wondered if you could comment on that. Well, do you think it's gone that far?
No, I mean, you very, very eloquently put. I agree completely with what you're saying. There's a number of things happening. One is history. They use their history as an excuse to go postmodern, because it's convenient. It's convenient in the sense that they can depend on us for their security and not have to worry about their own. And then they can moralize back to us that they're superior to us because we're out there doing the dirty work they're not willing to do, and not only in Europe during the Cold War, but certainly in other parts of the world. But they also have, as you rightly put, I mean, there's a whole intellectual force going into the whole postmodern movement of relativism, and nothing matters, and all of that works its way into the rationalization of these ideas that we're talking about here, including anti-Americanism. And I don't know what else to call it, but it's decadence. It's a lack of faith in their own civilization. They have turned their back on what was great about their civilization. And I suppose if you're a German, I could understand, I could be a bit ambivalent about that. But frankly, Germany in the 18th century was fully integrated into the Enlightenment. And, you know, Leibniz and others, they have a lot to be proud of. But they, instead of dealing with that, they get obsessed with understandably so, what happened with Nazi Germany. But they don't face it directly. They deal with this sort of psychological misdirection of where I had a German diplomat sit in my office when I was assistant secretary and say to me, he says, "We Germans see one of our major roles is to make sure that you Americans live up to your own standards." He was a lawyer.
Sorry, we don't have any more time. I know it's a shame, but we need one more. Okay, one more. Last, very short. This is the last one. I was just going to say, I
was very worried about this topic when we discussed this, but I want to congratulate this panel and all the panels for not, because anti-Americanism sounds defensive. I mean, it even sounds like we're the victims of something. But I like everybody who talked about it, either talked about the past when we had the Soviet Union against us, or Europe today, as Kim did, which is kind of irrelevant to our problems. And then ending up with Bob here saying the problem is us. That's the problem, not what they think of us. It's us. So thank you.
Thank you. No more.
Yeah, I hate to bring this to a halt, but the price of progress is we are experimenting with this new procedure with two breakout sessions. This is one of the rooms that will be one of the breakout sessions, and we have to rearrange the chairs, and we only have a half an hour to do it. So you can continue your conversation. Go out and have a cup of coffee, get a Coke. And this is the room for the family, church, and little platoons. Capitalism is around the corner. So we'll see you at 4 o'clock.
I had very much to say because
I think it's so important. Yeah. It is different right now, huh?
I was gratified this year.
I'm sorry, you were waiting for
talking about it. That's all right. I didn't realize. American. That's a way a lot of people are.
Thank you.
Just a little
Congratulations.